Welcome to the Bike Talk with Dave podcast. I'm your host, Dave Mabel, and I'm really very thankful that so many of you tune in for each episode. And hey, while we're at it, if you have any suggestions for guests or topics, I'd love to hear them. Just shoot me a DM on my Bike Talk with Dave Instagram account, and I'd love to connect. I'd love to hear about them. Speaking of Instagram, how's this for a segue? This week's guest also has an Instagram account. Kurt Refsnyder is one of the greats when it comes to super long, difficult, mountainous, and often cold and snowy bikepacking adventures. He's been to Nome, Alaska on the Iditarod Trail, finished the Tour Divide in 15 days, and has reached the Master of the Universe status on the Arizona Trail. Now, we all like to ride our bikes, but generally we have to balance our love of riding bikes with that which pays our bills. And if we're really fortunate, that which pays our bills is also something that fulfills us. And if you're super duper fortunate and smart, you'll combine all of that into one. Kurt, who was a professor of geology, took his love of geology and his passion for teaching, and he found a way to incorporate his cycling into all of that and led students on a geology through bikepacking course at Prescott College in Arizona. And since then, he's been busy with not only his coaching, but has now chosen to direct his energy toward co-founding and developing Bikepacking Roots to grow and advocate for the bikepacking community. A recent success of Bikepacking Roots was helping to develop and pass a new national law, the BOLT Act, or Biking on Long Distance Trails Act. It's a part of the larger and very outdoor recreationally friendly Explore Act, both of which we'll hear about here in this conversation. And if he hasn't been busy enough with all of that, he's also an athlete ambassador of POW, the Protect Our Winters organization, which we'll talk about as well. And I gotta tease you a bit, Kurt and I discovered a little mutual history together as well. So I hope you enjoy getting to know my guest, Kurt Refsnyder. Kurt Refsnyder, what a treat to have you on Bike Talk with Dave. And I honestly can't believe we're talking today because you just literally got back from Fat Pursuit. So welcome home to your yurt, and thanks for hopping on a call. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for the invitation, Dave. Excited to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So we've got a lot to talk about. I think I mentioned in our little pre-pod conversation that this could be a five-episode episode. we're not going to do that to everybody. But we do have a lot to talk about and some very exciting news that will affect the cycling community, I think, for years to come. And I don't know. We'll go from there. But I don't know that everybody knows who Kurt Refsnyder is. So who the heck are you?
Who am I? I ask myself that fairly often. Yeah. What am I doing?
I'm sure you do. I did a little intro in my intro of stuff you've done, but you're quite the bikepacker. How did you get to be so prolific a bikepacking machine? Where'd you start riding?
The road I took. I was a roadie for a long time, actually, and I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Minnesota, went to college in Western Minnesota, went to grad school for a couple years in Wisconsin, and was on a elite road team that was out of Iowa. And so I spent a lot of time racing on the road in Iowa years ago.
With who?
It was the All Nine Yards team out of Des Moines. Lane Anderson was the main guy behind that.
Dave Mabel. That was my team.
That was your team?
You were on my team.
That's right.
That's hilarious. I was a lowly cat 3 who had to beg to get the kit. But Lane and I ran that team.
Yeah. And so I was with Jim Holmes. We were the two guys that lived over in Wisconsin. And so we never got to train with any of you or ride with any of you. We just came down for race weekends and usually do our thing in the Pro 1-2 race. And then we're so shelled that didn't have any energy for much of anything else. And so, yeah, that was a so few funny. Years.
Listen, oh, I love it. I'm going to tell you that I appreciate that you described it as an elite road team. So thank you for saying that.
For me at the time, that is sure what it felt like, because I was just trying to hang on to everyone else and learn so much from everyone else. And we were able to duke it out and get some wins in those races. So it was, yeah, it was great. It was a hard racing scene. And the thing that was so striking to me was it seemed so friendly at the time, which isn't the road world everywhere. And then I moved to Boulder, Colorado, and it was the antithesis of racing in Iowa in so many ways. The level was higher because there were so many more pros. Not to say that the level in Iowa wasn't high, but it was just the depth in Colorado was so much greater, and it was just not friendly at all like the Iowa scene was. I missed Iowa after that. I really enjoyed the racing and learned so much from those events. So... yeah. So that was
a small world. So, okay. Yeah. I did that same elite road team.
And then
I did not go the way of ultra marathon bikepacking machine, but you did.
Well,
how'd you go from
road
to that?
So Jim Holmes, who was on that team also, he kind of took me under his wing and taught me so much. He got me into cyclocross. And when I moved to Colorado, that's what I started to focus on. And that was the main focus for quite a few years, and traveled a ton, did a lot of the East Coast races, and raced at Nationals a bunch of years in a row, and then kind of got tired of going around in little circles all the time, even though it was fun. It was like kind of the same little parks every year in different places. And there was a newer bikepacking race. I mean, there only were a handful of bikepacking races in the country or in the world at that point. That was like 2008. There's one out in Western Colorado called the Grand Loop, which I was like 360 miles. And I was like, oh, maybe I could do that. I still had a mountain bike from years before. And so got on that, did some training, and then showed up for the race. Had no idea what I was getting into. Managed to survive. Took like 3 days to do it. I was like, I'm never doing that again. And that was my first sort of bikepacking experience, very much the race side of it. And, you know, 2 weeks later, I was like, huh, I actually learned a lot. I think I could go way faster. And so then... you know, started to get more into it on the racing, purely on the racing side, because that's what I saw myself as at that point was just a pure bike racer. But it wasn't long before I started doing some bikepacking trips without, you know, racing goals or speed as a goal. And a few years later, did a few longer tours, did a month long solo trip across southern Utah. It was the most circuitous route you could imagine. There were no real bikepacking routes developed in that area aside from a couple that Dave Harris out in St. George had put together at that point. And so followed some of his stuff, and then just had literally a stack of maps that I was carrying and figured out where I was going as I went along. And it was a amazing trip, really hard, just hot terrain, was difficult. It was summer. So quite warm in the desert, and it definitely changed the direction of my own thinking of what I wanted to be doing with bikes. I started thinking at that point a lot more about putting together routes for other people to ride, and about just what I wanted to be doing with long distance riding. And it definitely wasn't just racing anymore at that point, because there's such a side of learning more about the landscape, being a geologist. That was a way that I could really literally connect things in my head of, you know, instead of just seeing the geology here and there and over there, if you rode between all of that, you see the geology all the way through that zone, and you can link together mentally exactly what's happening the whole way. And so it's a pretty incredible way of seeing the landscape at bike speed. And so that was, you know, definitely that trip in 2013, I guess, was kind of a big turning point for me and the bikepacking, the role that bikepacking plays for me. And after that, you know, I've obviously kept racing a fair bit in these bikepacking events. Don't do as much as I used to, but do a lot of trips, whether they're just, you know, an overnighter like I did the other day to ride up to the Fat Pursuit race, or big, you know, expeditionary type adventures.
Well, you certainly, as far as strapping a number on, whew, you've got a good resume. Tour Divide finisher, you won that once. Arizona Trail 9 times on the 300, 2 times on the 750, Unbound XL finisher. You did Unbound XL, which is enough for most people, but you rode your bike there from Arizona.
My teammate Kate Boyle had that idea that, oh, what if we both rode there and then raced this past year?
Oh, great. I was like,
oh, that
idea.
Sounds fun. I love riding places from home. And
great.
Yeah, 14 days to get there and
one day to do it.
Yep.
That's funny. Iditarod, you've done the Iditarod. You won the 350 in 2020, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Was Tyson?
Yep.
Flaherty, did he race him?
He was there that year, and Clint Hodges. All three of us were kind of up, not necessarily together, but like within an hour or two of each other for pretty much the entire race.
And Tyson's fast, man. I mean, Tyson's won that.
Tyson's ridiculously fast. I don't like racing him. He's so strong, and he's like the nicest, kindest guy you can imagine in the middle of a race. And so you kind of forget how strong he is because of how nice he's being. And then he just like seemingly effortlessly pulls away from you. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's Tyson. I forgot.
Yeah. You know what's amazing about that to people like me who still enjoy a 45-minute criterium? It's 350 miles on, I'm going to call it, snowmobile/snow machine trail, dog sled trail, through the freaking mountains, through the Alaska range. And you kids are racing it. It's a race. It's not a survival test. It is how fast can we go? You race fast and light. And that's kind of mind blowing because for everyone else who is like mortal, it's a survival race. Like, if I can get there in five, I think you have 10 days to get to McGrath. 10. And you guys,
some years that's what it takes.
48 hours?
No, the year I did it was like just under 4 days, I think. We had some pretty rough conditions, had a big storm that came through. We had one night where temperatures dropped. The trail became just like sugar snow. Like, you could not ride anything. And it was, what did it get down to? Minus 45. I think that night. And so just literally walked through the night pushing our bikes in minus 45. And that was the last night we were out there. And so we all got into Nikolai within, I don't know, 25 minutes of each other or something like that. And all left within about 5 minutes of each other a few hours later. And that was where I was just my old road racing instincts kicked in. Like, there was just a moment where I could tell Tyson was kind of dragging. And so I was like, I should go hard and see if I can actually get away. The whole race up until that point, I had just been letting him and Clint set the pace. I come from Arizona. I haven't done a ton of riding in winter. I've never been in temperatures that cold before that event. And so I was just trying to be as conservative as possible, focus on taking care of myself, because that I knew how to do. If I could just eat enough, take care of my body, I was like, okay, I can get through this, I think. And if I'm, rested enough and fueled enough, then that will let me be a little bit more careful in taking care of everything else and make smarter decisions than I might otherwise if I was, just unraveling. And there's just that moment that I could tell Tyson was a little bit more work than he had seemed the whole time. And then Clint, when I caught up to him just ahead, he seemed the same as well. I was like, maybe this is my chance. And that was like 50 miles from the end. Had no idea what the trail condition was like for those 50 miles. But I just went literally as hard as I could at that point, which means you're going like 8 miles an hour, probably pushing so hard to go
8 miles an hour.
Yeah. Yep.
did you audibly yell Leroy Jenkins when you went?
I didn't say anything at all. Like, didn't, I had idea what exactly was going on. And after that, I was just like, ride as hard as I can. It's like, I need to get out of sight. and you know, and road racing, that's the key to a successful breakaway. Yeah, like once you get out of sight, you've got a much better chance of them kind of just letting up a little bit and not knowing quite how close you may be. And it was just ridiculous. Like, first there was a bog, like, you know, big open bog to get across in the before the next stretch of woods. And it's like, oh, I can, you know, get out of sight here. And the next one was a little bigger, and the next one was a little bigger. And before long, there's these, you know, big lakes that you're crossing that are like 15 minutes to get across. And you can see the person 15 minutes away as a little spot out there. And so I was just, you know, trying to go hard enough to get out of sight in that kind of an environment, which was no small feat. And the whole time I was just thinking, my friend Chloe Woodruff, who lived in Prescott for a while, she raced in the Olympics, mountain bike, and she had just won a World Cup short track with a huge attack. And I kept thinking of that attack, which was hilarious because for her, you know, that's like a 22 minute race or something. And she put in this massive attack and got away with, you know, two laps to go or something, which is 4 minutes or, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah, yeah.
But just, you know, such an inspiration to see that kind of ride. And was like, I need to just be able to have that much guts here and hope that things work out. And it did. Amazingly, it worked out. I was shocked to win that because I'd felt so out of my element for so much of that race. And
yeah, right, that's up awesome. And those boys are veterans for sure. I met them both the year before. I met them both the year before when I was making my film. I see also on your resume here, and I got a bone to pick with you because you you've got let's see, where's, I printed it out and I'm okay, Iditarod Trail Through Ride, and then you've got in parentheses 950 miles to Nome, and we all know it's 1,000 miles to Nome. Because that's the name of my film, damn it. How dare you?
It's a much rounder number. I think if you go the southern route, it's shorter. Northern route's a little longer.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Definitely rounds up to 1,000.
In-ish. Rounds up to 1,000 for sure. But Peter Inman and John Logar finished together the year I was there, 2019. And in the film, they're riding into Nome. And I think John asked Peter, so what do you got for mileage? And Peter's like, oh, 983. And I was like, damn it, it's not even 1,000 miles. We all know it's 1,000 miles.
It feels like way more than 1,000 miles.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure it does. I'm sure. And then at the bottom of your resume, I'm just super, like, burying the lead, cyclocross national championships medal in the collegiate race. Dude, why is that not at the top?
It's so different from everything I do now.
It is so different. It's like this, oh yeah, and I also got a medal at the Collegiate National Cyclocross Championships. I thought that was kind of funny, but congratulations on your medal.
Thanks. I was stoked. It was, well, we were D2, so a little less competitive than the D1 side of things, but we all raced together. I think I was like sixth in the race that year. Battle with Pete Stetna, which was...
Oh, cool.
I mean, it was super fun. He's great. And it's really funny because, you know, we knew each other then a little bit through collegiate racing. And at that point, you know, he was like 20 and I was in grad school. So I was probably 28 or something like that. And then 26. And then we went very different directions. He ended up in the World Tour and I ended up being a geology professor for a while. And now it's funny, in the last few years, we've come back and have kind of met in the middle, that he's been doing things like chasing the Cocopelli Trail record and broke my record on that a couple years ago. And just a lot, definitely interests are converging now that he's left the World Tour and looking for more kind of big adventurous stuff. And I've been trying to push my pace on some of those things. And apparently the distances that we're interested in kind of converge at the like 150 mile level.
Oh, that's interesting. It's kind of cool how, I mean, shoot, we're all connected, aren't we? In so many ways, in so many ways. And I want to talk about your connection to Caitlin. Caitlin Boyle, or Kate, what do you call her?
Yeah, Kate. Yeah.
Kate. From my understanding, and I heard a podcast of hers, it might have been on Adventure Sports Podcast. I don't remember what she was on.
Yeah, she was on that a couple years ago.
And she talked about... was she in school at your school? Was she taking class from you? at Prescott
No,
College?
she was another instructor there. Well, she went to college had graduated years before, and then she went on, she taught for Knowles National Outdoor Leadership School and Prescott College in outdoor education for a long time. And we met there, and then we co-taught and co-created the Geology Through Bikepacking course.
Tell me about that course. I find that super interesting, where you combine cycling with a collegiate, like people got credit to ride their bikes and study rocks.
And it was a really rigorous course. Like, it was a quite a challenging one, both to teach and for the students in there. And it was phenomenal. Like, it was such a fun one. It was, I think Kate and I both agreed that of all the courses we've taught, that one was the most challenging to do. Huh. And it was that school has a really cool format that I think it's actually changed since I left, but at that point it was a 1 month block and then a 10-week semester. And so the block courses were just 4 weeks, very intensive. You, as an instructor, you had the students for that entire 4 weeks, and you could do whatever you wanted as long as you could get permits from land managers and you had the budget to do it. And so our vision for that course was, let's do a series of bikepacking trips that are each kind of increasingly demanding and teach kind of a progressive suite of skills throughout them, and have the students move more and more into leadership roles and get practice leading groups on bikes through that whole sequence. And then parallel to that part of the curriculum was the geology curriculum that was more or less moving from the oldest part of the geologic history of the Colorado Plateau region to the youngest part. And so each of the trips, we were in younger and younger pieces of that story, geologically speaking. And so it was a neat challenge to try to put together bikepacking routes or find bikepacking routes that others had put together that were in the right ages of rocks for each of those parts of the story. And so ended up being some stuff in the Grand Canyon region, a little bit right outside of Prescott, where we had the oldest rocks that are kind of underlying everything on the Colorado Plateau. So they're the early part of the story. Did some riding up by Bryce Canyon 1 year. Did White Rim outside of Moab all 3 years we taught the course. And then what else did we do? One of the years that we ended with a 4-day trip in that Bryce Canyon area, a couple of years we went up to Crested Butte and used the riding up there as the youngest part of the geologic story. And yeah, it was phenomenal. We had 12 students every time we taught it. And so managing 12 mostly new, completely new to bikepacking individuals. Most folks were good riders. Like, we had some criteria for who actually could sign up for the class, because we didn't need them to be super strong athletes, but we needed them to be at least competent riding on kind of more rugged jeep roads and things like that, and at least have the fitness that they could be riding for, you know, a decent number of hours each day, like four hours pedaling or something like that, and then also have the energy along the way for lessons during the day, and then everything in the evening that they needed to do to take care of themselves and homework and get ready for the next day. So it was rigorous, but super fun to teach. And I think for both Kate and me, was really instrumental in helping us understand what needs to be done to effectively prepare other people for bikepacking and help other people get ready to go out and have really, really good, powerful experiences on their own. And so that's come through into like the guidebook that we wrote for bikepacking. And then for the webinar series that Kate did for Bikepacking Routes last winter and is now doing a different one this winter, a lot of that comes back to things that we learned from that course and learned from our students.
Well, I also feel like that was kind of the beginning of your relationship, which led to the founding of Bikepacking Routes organization. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. Yeah. What is that, and what are you guys doing with that?
Yeah, so that, I think... You're very right that the experiences Kate and I had teaching that course for a few years, and then we did some other big adventures bikepacking in those years. And that really, through a whole series of different events, things that happened at the time with the kind of growing bikepacking community in, what would that have been, like 2016, 2015 era? That was when it was really gaining visibility. There were some issues in certain races and on certain routes with people that were out bikepacking them or racing them not setting good examples for being stewards of where they were riding, or, you know, camping in private barns and, you know, leaving stuff behind, like just things that shouldn't be happening. And it was pretty clear to us that there was some education needed, because a lot of these people were coming from like the, you know, cycling racer world and not from the backcountry travel world, the outdoor enthusiast world necessarily. So there were some skills that just were missing from some of those folks. And then it was also a time when it was becoming really clear how much appetite there was for new bikepacking routes, and how much need there was for, and the growing need for, some sort of organization interface between the bikepacking community and land managers, like the Forest Service, like the BLM, in places where what we were starting to do as a community had different needs than what mountain bikers necessarily had been doing as a user group in the past, like kind of some of these connectivity needs that bikepackers have that maybe places that most cyclists don't necessarily want to ride, or it's too far out to, you know, see much use by bikes. But for connecting bikepacking routes together, those sorts of connections are key. And there were a few other instances in that era of the cycling community losing access to trails that had been being used for bikepacking, and like IMBA was kind of shifting their focus away from backcountry trails and more to front country trails. And that was kind of the beginning of their era of more trails close to home and that approach, which is, I mean, the reality is that's where most people are going to ride. That's where they're going to have the biggest impact as an organization. So it makes total sense to put most of the energy there. But it meant that there was less advocacy being done for backcountry trails, and more of that was falling on the, you know, local small trail organization, if there was one in that area. And so we saw all of those as kind of areas that a nonprofit dedicated to the bikepacking community could be a big help. And so that, I guess that was 2017 when we started trying to figure out how to actually make that happen. And our first approach was, let's work with Adventure Cycling to try to create this, because they're, you know, very much road oriented. They've done some really impact. I mean, the Great Divide mountain bike route they created is without a doubt the most influential bikepacking route that's ever been created anywhere. And it's done so much for the bikepacking community. And so we approached them with an idea of like a self-funding, dirt focused kind of branch within ACA. And their ED's approach or response, their ED at the time, who's now several EDs ago, but he was like, I think if you create something like that, you'll be really successful. And it's not something that we're positioned to be involved with right now. And so that led us down the road of like, well, how do we create a nonprofit? This, we don't know anything about this. We're college instructors. And so, but we got a board of directors together of people that helped us through that process. We got it off the ground, and well, that was 2017 when we launched. A few years later, we were up to a few thousand members. I was the ED for maybe, I guess, 4 years, 4.5 years or something like that before I stepped out. And then we hired an ED that was, I think she was like 3/4 time. And then this last year, hired Noelle Battle, who's the current ED, and she's the first full-time ED. And the staffing has continued to grow beneath the ED for more support in each of the different areas that we put emphasis. And membership, I don't even know what the current membership is. I've stepped out of any official role with the organization at this point after being routes director for a couple years, and now moving on to some other projects. And it was, I had a conversation with somebody a couple years ago or last year that was just asking about how, like, what my kind of progression was within the organization. And at the end of sharing that, she was like, huh, it sounds like you've made yourself obsolete, which kind of was the goal. Like, neither Kate nor I necessarily wanted to be leading a nonprofit organization, but we felt very strongly that organization is something that would be really positive for the community to have. And so it's been amazing to see the support from the bikepacking community for bikepacking routes continue to increase and increase and increase. And now to be at a point where it is, I don't want to say it's running itself. Noelle is running it, and she's doing a fantastic job. And everyone else that's involved, the board of directors just brought on a group of new folks that are like just looking at who's there, it's like, wow, this is, it's incredible to see these folks being involved with this little organization. And then with the what we can get into in a bit here, the Bolt Act, that was the first federal legislation to mention bike packing, just got signed into law by President Biden, what, a week ago, 10 days ago, something like that. And yep, that was something Bikepacking Roots was really, really involved with making, getting it through Congress over the last 4 years, I guess. And so seeing this idea that we had years ago continue to grow and gain support and bring more people on, and now be doing it all without us needing to be involved at this point is really special to see.
You say doing it all. What is all? What what specifically does Bikepacking Roots do?
Yeah, so right now the main emphasis areas, there's a big focus on education. And like last winter, there was the webinar series that Kate Boyle did that was all about like kind of an introductory series of all the things you need to know about bikepacking and skills to develop. And I forget how many episodes there were, 8 or so episodes, but there were like 600 people that were signing up for each one, which is incredible to see. And so that's back this year. I think there's only three or four this winter, kind of building on a few of those from last year. So there's a big education initiative with trying to get more people into bikepacking and give them the skills and the bits of info that you can give, you know, remotely without going out on a trip with people necessarily, to be able to get out there and do it on their own. There's a big focus on building community. And that's something that while I was ED was a big challenge because we had such limited capacity and couldn't be all over the country doing things. And so we did a few in-person events, but not too many. They were very much geared toward, you know, first-time bikepackers. And now in just this past year in 2024, there's been a whole new program that Noel rolled out of community community stewards and community members that are organizing group events and workshops all around the country. And great. So I don't know exactly how many, there were like 20 or so of those around the country last year. There's a training program that the folks organizing those go through that makes sure they're kind of up to the, just, I don't want to say standards, but the expectations that we organizationally have for what those would look like. I say we, I wasn't involved in that process at all. And
you can say we, you're a founder.
And then there's the route development side of things, which that's what I was most involved with the last few years after I stepped out of the executive director role. And so we've got both the suite of what we call signature routes that are ones that we internally have developed. And so those are usually some pretty sizable ones, pretty ambitious, and have quite extensive resources to go along with them. So those are like the Western Wildlands route that runs parallel to the Great Divide route all the way down the country. There's a whole series of east-west links between the Great Divide route and the Western Wildlands route to make links between them. There's the Bears Ears loops that we put together during the last Trump presidency when the Bears Ears National Monument was being threatened and then was downsized considerably. The Northwoods route up in your neck of the woods is another one of those. And then I was just heavily involved with this project in Northwest Arkansas, working with the city of Fayetteville to create a series of bikepacking loops there, which was, this was a really cool project that was like years in the making. And then finally all the pieces fell into place to create this progressive series of bikepacking loops, which is something that we had ideas for. No one had ever done anywhere before, but it's basically like somewhere you can go. There are now 5-6 loops in that area, ranging from a few overnighters to 2-nighters to 3-nighters to something you could make even bigger than that by linking a few other loops together. And they're each kind of progressively more demanding in different ways. So there's a very beginner-friendly route. There's another overnighter that's just a little bit harder than that. Another one that's a little bit more rugged just based on the topography of where it is. And they each highlight, you know, one goes up to Bentonville and you experience what's going on bike-wise in that area. One goes out to Devil's Den State Park. There's bikepacking camping in the state park, which is a new thing as of last year. And then there's some bigger routes that go down through the mountains east of Devil's Den State Park, the Boston Mountains, which are the highest of the Ozarks. And then another one that goes out to the Buffalo River Zone and highlights that gorgeous corridor in that area. And so it's the kind of thing that if you want to get into bikepacking and live in that region, these routes are designed for you to have, you know, a year's worth of experiences or something like that, and build confidence on these routes that get progressively harder and progressively more remote. So they're a little bit less beginner friendly the farther along you go. So that was something that I was really excited to be able to finally create in that area. And so that was like 2 weeks of, I think I drove like 1,000 miles of Ozark dirt roads in my truck when I was down there to just check them all out. Did some riding too, did a fair bit on ride on my bike, but it was a lot of driving to check out all the different potential options and link together the stuff that created the kinds of experiences we wanted to create for folks. So that was a really fun one working with the city of Fayetteville. Fayetteville was the...
Yeah, they have been very progressive on developing bike stuff, not just the mountain biking, but making Northwest Arkansas, Northern Arkansas, really a cycling destination for...
Exactly, yeah, and so much of that has been up in the Bentonville area, and Fayetteville's been building some really cool mountain bike trails, but they just don't have as much terrain for it as Bentonville. But what they do have is the terrain for some really cool bike packing right from Fayetteville. And so that was why Experience Fayetteville was so excited for this project. Was like, well, we can't do exactly what Bentonville's doing, but we can do something way better for bike packers in this area. And they're totally right.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. So that route development side is a big piece of it. And then something else Noel rolled out last year was the community routes project. And that was one we had had in the works for a few years. And that's one that works with stewards in different parts of the country that have put together routes that they're have put a lot of work into vetting. They've had people basically test riding them and have really nice resources put together already, and that these stewards are dedicating to continue to keep those routes and the resources up to date as things on the ground change, or as they hear more from folks that may want more of this or less of this on the route, things like that. And so the goal is that those are very much, you know, community focused routes and stewarded locally, but we can help with helping them bring more people to see those routes. So that's been a really
focused
fun one.
Focused on dirt, or can it be all surfaces?
We mostly focus on dirt. I think the Community Routes Project routes are, I think one of the criteria is they should be at least 50% dirt. And that can be, you know, mellow dirt road. There's some that are a lot of rail trail. So there's flexibility in it. But the main focus is like they're not road touring routes.
Yeah, dig it. Cool. Well, I know that your involvement with bikepacking routes kind of connected you to the resurrection, maybe is the right word, of the BOLT Act, the Biking on Long Distance Trails Act that you just talked about was very recently signed into law. Tell me about your involvement with the BOLT Act. What is it? Why should we be excited about that?
Yeah, it's super exciting. So the other big piece of bikepacking routes that I didn't get to just now that is a primary part of the mission is advocacy. And that can look, I mean, advocacy, if you ask different people, you get 10 different answers from 10 different people for what bike advocacy is. And it's all stuff that's really important, whether it's community advocacy, advocating for growing the diversity within the bikepacking community, whether it's advocating for public lands, public land access, advocating for trails, all of that. And so that's all stuff that Bikepacking Routes has in one way or another been really involved with in recent years. And the BOLT Act very much is on the kind of the public lands access trails side of advocacy. And this was one that IMBA, International Mountain Bike Association, came to us 4 years ago, I think. And they had, I don't know exactly the story of how this happened, but the BOLT Act itself had been written like a decade or more ago, or drafted at least. And it never went anywhere. It just ended up filed away in some cabinet in Washington. And it was pulled back out like 4 years ago or so. And started some conversations with congressional representatives from a few Western states that have a lot of lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management, the BLM. And there's not a ton of recreational infrastructure trails on BLM land in the Western part of the U.S., where pretty much all BLM land is. And those representatives see the value in outdoor recreation for building a state's economy. And they connected that to, well, how can we compel the BLM to do more to support outdoor recreation, and specifically long distance trails that are open to bikes, is where that conversation had gone. And so the Bolt Act kind of was resurrected at that point with the goal of, let's try to compel land managers, BLM, and then ultimately open up to all federal land managers, mainly the BLM and the Forest Service, to do more to support long distance bike routes. And IMBA asked us to get involved. And so Kate Boylan and I, representing Bikepacking Routes, got really involved in this maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I forget exactly when it was. And at that point, the language of the draft bill, which hadn't quite gone into committee yet or gone through markup, it was fairly vague in just what a long distance trail was and what a long distance bike trail was. So Kate and I worked to really tighten up that language for just what it is. And I think it ultimately settled on either 70 or 80 miles long or longer is long distance. And then for bike trails, we had a lot of discussion around like what actually should that mean? Because there's paved bike trails, there's gravel rail trails, there's single track, there are things like the Great Divide Mountain Bike Route or the Western Wildlands Route that are 2,700 miles of linked up dirt roads and jeep roads. They're all bike trails or bike routes in one way or another. And the reality is we don't need land manager involvement, public land manager involvement, for things like the Great Divide Mountain Bike Route or the Western Wildlands Route. Those were created with zero involvement. There doesn't need to be any permitting or anything like that from land managers.
It's just a route on a map of
exactly public roads. It's roads that are already open to the public. Nothing new needs to be built. That's part of the beauty of those sorts of routes, is that you don't need to put any money into new infrastructure for them. It's just building a new opportunity with what's there already. And there's places that that kind of thing can be done with single track, but most places there's a lot of work that needs to be done, whether it's trail work for improving the single track, for connecting things. And so the conversation very much migrated toward like natural surface trails and single track trails. So much more mountain bikey type stuff. And that's, you know, I'm very much a mountain biker myself. I was really excited by that prospect because there's so many really cool long distance trails out there that could be phenomenal for a lot of people, but right now are just hard enough or over the top demanding enough that it takes a really strong rider who doesn't mind a lot of adversity to get out there and enjoy the experience. But improving those trails, some clearing, the, you know, things to bring the trail up to a non-primitive standard would make a huge difference. And so those could be things like the Alpine 7 trail up in Western Montana, sections of the Continental Divide trail in places. And then there's long distance trails like the Arizona Trail, the Colorado Trail, that have very dedicated organizations behind them. There's a ton of great work they're doing. Those are examples of like, if you put a lot of resources into a long distance trail, you can have something amazing. And so the Bolt Act is kind of aiming more on the smaller scale side of things. Like I think ultimately it's going to benefit a lot of trails in the like 70 to 150 mile range, something like that, like the Mottahe Trail in Western North Dakota, which is another fantastic one. The Save the Mottahe organization's done amazing work on that in recent years. They were really involved in the advocacy for the Bolt Act in the last couple of years. And for example, on that trail, there's one small section where the trail goes through wilderness. That part's closed to bikes. And so there's no good bike detour around it. And the Forest Service up there hasn't been all that willing to engage in finding a solution for that, because they're like, oh, there's dirt roads you can follow to get around, which is true, but they're pretty circuitous and there's some private land issues. So the Bolt Act, ultimately, what it's going to do, or what the language is compelling the Forest Service and the BLM to do, is identify a suite of, I think it's like 10 existing long distance trails that need work done on them. And then another suite of trails that are going to be concepts because they don't exist yet. What are some new ones that can be created? Whether that's linking together some existing stuff and filling in gaps, or completely new built trail. So that's much longer term, slower process to do. Improving existing trail, that's usually a much faster process. The biggest challenge with the Bolt Act is there's no money in it at this point. It's basically just compelling the BLM and the Forest Service to engage in this process. And unfortunately, those agencies don't have much in the way of resources to do that, and they're going to have even less in the next presidential administration. So it's going to fall on organizations that are probably the ones that have been very involved so far in the advocacy for it, which has been IMBA, which has been Bikepacking Roots, which has been Outdoor Alliance. And then there are some smaller trail organizations like the Save the Mottahay, the Orogenesis Collective that's creating the big route, which is, it's a Bikepacking Roots project also, but down the West Coast from Canada down to the Baja Divide and then down the Baja Divide. So that's a 5,000 mile route that's in development. That'll be a lot of single track along the way. Those organizations all were heavily involved in the advocacy last few years. Adventure Cycling was really involved for a couple years and then had to step back recently, and so they weren't involved this last year. But the last year, it's been amazing to see the work that IMBA's done. Noelle at Bikepacking Roots has been so engaged, made several trips to Washington to meet with legislators about that. And Outdoor Alliance brought together this bigger package of outdoor recreation related bills into the Explore Act, which is, so the Bolt Act was part of that. And that whole package is what got passed by Congress at the very end of the year and then just signed into to law by Biden like a week ago or so.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. And the Explore Act is expanding public lands outdoor recreation experience.
That includes the Bolt Act that's specific to cycling. There's some legislation specific to the climbing community. There's some related to a lot of kind of federal regulations for commercial activity on public lands, like commercial filming. They've made that easier for very small projects that you don't need a permit anymore. If, like, I wanted to go out and film a friend for something that was going to have money involved somehow, that doesn't need a permit anymore if we're not really impacting anyone around us, because it's just a small operation. There's a lot of, or I should say a lot, there's another piece of legislation in there around, it's the Recreation Not Red Tape bill, I think, that is around permitting for outfitters and guides and places like Prescott College that I used to work, like educational or nonprofit institutions that use public lands for whatever it is that they do that is going to hopefully help ease the process to get permits for those sorts of activities. So lots of different things in there that will impact different parts of the outdoor community.
Yeah, it's cool that, I mean, I'm trying to picture like Mitch McConnell and Chuck Grassley getting excited about the outdoor recreation experience and long distance trails on dirt and things like that. But it passed. It made it through, and it's part of the law of the United States of America, and how far we've come in such a short time.
To have the word bikepacking in federal legislation, that's amazing, considering that
it is amazing.
I think Scott Morris was the one that kind of popularized the term bikepacking for what it is that most of us think about bikepacking as being. And that had, I mean, I don't know, he created bikepacking.net webpage in, what, probably 2003 or 2004, something like that. And that was kind of the beginning of the movement. And that's only two decades ago. So that's for an outdoor recreation community, that's fast-paced movement.
Yeah, for sure. And it'll be super interesting to see where this leads. So many times, like, really all you need is a spark. And whether it's related to this Bolt Act or not, the fact that it exists and it's a conversation could cause, I don't want to use the word fire right now.
Yeah.
Could cause some excitement in the community to develop some trails. You and I talked before we hit record, and I was involved in the development of our local mountain bike trails, which is a 7.5, like the very first trail we got was a 7.5 mile long floodplain trail. Like, you go up and back. It's 7.5 miles one way, turn around, go back. You got 15 mile ride, flat as a pancake. it's very, twisty and turny and flowy. It's super fun. It's still one of my favorites, but, it was definitely a consolation prize. Like, it's not the trail we really wanted, but we're like, okay, we got to start somewhere. This is easy. It exists. Like, let's just see if we can get this passed and we'll go from there. And other trails have developed because of that, which is super cool. But when we got it, we're like, okay, it's along the Des Moines River. There's a ton of land along the Des Moines River. Like, this floodplain extends for miles and miles and miles. Let's develop this trail for miles and miles and miles. It could be a 150-mile-long trail crisscrossing the state of Iowa along this river and have little spots to camp.
That would be amazing, and, yeah.
You know, I'm going to bring up the conversation with our local community and see if we can get that spark going. So we may not get Chuck Grassley out here to, you know, wave his wand or anything, but the fact that we're having this conversation could spark other people to think like, oh, hey, I've been thinking about this, whatever this is. But
I hope so. I really do.
Something like this brings it to the forefront and gets people talking and ideas moving and some creativity and maybe some inertia to get
bikepacking trails. I think it really will. And I mean, I saw that myself. I was doing some work with a nonprofit out of Wyoming last summer, Wyoming Pathways, and the Bridger Teton National Forest, and a new kind of trails restoration project down in southwestern Wyoming. And the director of Wyoming Pathways had seen that one of the example trails we included in the Bolt Act, not in the act itself, but in some of the kind of documentation along with it, where we included a list of example trails that we thought represent what the goal is for trails that could benefit from restoration, and then kind of conceptual ideas for what new ones could be. And we included the Wyoming Range National Recreation Trail in there, which is an amazing trail. Now, let me change that, reword that. It's a trail through an amazing place. The trail itself is in incredibly rough condition. It's very primitive. It's a national recreation trail on paper, but it's one of the harder trails I've ever taken a bike on. I keep going back because it's so incredible. And thinking about what it could be with some work, I mean, it would rival the most beautiful parts of the Colorado Trail. And it's out in this remote range in western Wyoming with a bunch of potential to extend it farther south, farther through the range into this other ranger district I was working in. And so that nonprofit Wyoming Pathways, the ED had seen that the Wyoming Range Trail was mentioned in there. And he's like, Bolt Act? Huh, Wyoming Range Trail? This could be big. And so that got conversations going around it with him and the Forest Service. And then I got involved with in a different role down there doing some trail assessment work. But it sparked the conversation there. And so then I had a conversation with the Forest Service about, you know, here's a vision that I have for, you know, we could extend this trail through your ranger district. And they're like, huh, it could come through our ranger district. We like that. And so now there's an idea on paper that the trail is going to be extended through there. And as they start to extend the trail, it's going to be more conversation like, well, this part of the trail up here needs a lot of work too. Let's talk to that ranger district and see what we can get going in that area. So sometimes that's all it takes, is somebody to get excited about it, to start a conversation, and then more conversations follow. Hopefully things start happening. Yeah, it's already working. That was even before the Bolt Act got passed.
Yeah. And I feel like it doesn't, I mean, we all want $1 billion to be allocated to our hobbies, but even without $1 billion of federal money allocated, like, stuff can happen. You don't have to just sit on your hands and wait for somebody to write you a check. You can make things happen. So,
yep, totally. And that's a good place to plug your, whether it's your local nonprofit trail organization or national ones like IMBA, Bikepacking Roots. It's organizations like that that are going to make the next steps with the Bolt Act happen. Since the Forest Service and the BLM don't have the resources to actually run with any of this, it's going to be nonprofits that make things happen and interface with the land managers and keep this process moving forward and write the grants to get the money to actually do things on these trails and create the new trails that are envisioned. So support your organizations, pay attention to the conversations in the next couple years, because I'm sure you'll be hearing more about Bolt Act trail ideas and trail projects. And if those are trails that you're excited about, look at the organization that is the local steward of it. Support them, because they're going to need it.
Yeah. You mentioned supporting nonprofit organizations, and another one. This is my segue. I'm trying to segue smoothly here, and I'm not. I'm working on it. Another organization you're involved with as an Athlete Alliance member is POW, or Protect Our Winters. It was formed by Jeremy Jones, a snowboarder, who had the observation that, like, golly, there's less snow here this year than there was for the past 10 years. What's going on? And it's centered around climate change and protecting winters. Winter is a huge cash cow. I'm hanging up from this call. I'm throwing all my crap in my car, and we're driving to Colorado for a week of skiing and hiking. So snow is huge money. Snow is a huge resource. It's a water storage system for the West, for sure. Well, for everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's kind of going away. But tell me what you're doing with POW, what's your involvement there, and why is a cyclist a member of this kind of powder, Protect Our Winters?
Yeah, fantastic questions. Yeah, so my background academically is in kind of landscape evolution and long-term climate evolution and how that impacts landscapes, whether it's through, the main thing I looked at was ice sheets and glaciers and how they affect the landscape on long timescales, so thinking million-year timescales. And so I did a lot of work up in the high Canadian Arctic and in the Rocky Mountains in different places, so a lot of Arctic and Alpine type settings, and taught a lot about climate change. It's something that I've spent a ton of time engaged with. And then I left academia and ended up pursuing bike stuff full time for the past 6 years now, I guess. And that part, the like no longer being involved in either teaching about climate science or doing the research myself, felt kind of like a bit of a hole. And Protect Our Winters is an organization that has, since its inception, really involved athletes in a lot of ways to help spread messaging and help do advocacy work with legislators and politicians and be involved in things in a way that can help make a difference that a nonprofit just with staff alone can't necessarily do. And the organization started very much with the focus on winter exclusively, and they had an Athlete Alliance of basically skiers and snowboarders was kind of where they started. And they've been expanding dramatically because the reality is the changing climate is something that affects everybody in different ways, but one of the most powerful groups of people to potentially advocate for climate and climate-friendly initiatives is the outdoor community, or the outdoor state, as Protect Our Winters calls it. And that's made up of not just skiers and snowboarders, but it's people like us that ride bikes. It's runners, it's climbers, it's hunters and fishermen. It's a huge swath of different types of people that recreate in the outdoors in very different ways. And so the organization over the past, I don't know, 5 years or so, 6 years, has really been expanding to involve a lot more people beyond just winter enthusiasts. And so they have a whole group of athletes involved that are runners, and they created the bike team, that team used loosely, that I'm part of a couple years ago. And, you know, we've got people like Kate Courtney and Chris Blevins involved in it, going to Washington, meeting with legislators, advocating for different legislation. And, you know, you get an Olympian showing up and talking about something, they get people to listen to them. So that's part of what the organization is trying to do, is get all different types of people involved. They've been making a big push in the last few years to involve more hunters and anglers, which is, I think, really, really important to do, because some of those folks spend so much time out there. They've been doing that for generations and are so connected to the land and see how things are changing. And, you know, when I was down working in the Wyoming Range and talking to hunters that have been hunting as families down there for generations, and saying how it's, you know, they're trying to get Wyoming Game and Fish to extend or shift hunting season back later into the fall because it's too warm consistently now. And it's either making it, you know, it's changing the behavior of the elk that they're hunting, or it makes it too hard for them to keep the meat cold after they kill.
Sure.
And that creates all sorts of other problems. So, you know, they're seeing some of the same changes from a very different perspective. And Protect Our Winters as an organization is really involved behind the scenes in a lot of legislation that's kind of making its way toward Congress. And, you know, one of the big ones this year was on infrastructure and for green energy and for all these wind and solar projects. The places that the energy is being generated doesn't have the transmission capacity to actually move that energy to where it's going to be consumed. And so, you know, basically transmission lines. And there's, you know, that's a big stumbling block for kind of slowing down the transition to green energy. Is you can build all the windmills and solar farms you want in a particular area that's conducive toward it, but if you can't get that energy to where it needs to be, it's not actually helping the problem. And so PAO's been really involved with legislation that is working to kind of ease the process for creating those sorts of transmission line corridors and for getting communities along those corridors to actually be involved through some of the money in that, kind of involved in the projects going to community initiatives locally along those areas, instead of just having lines put through and nobody locally getting anything from it and not wanting them there. So trying to actually support the folks in the areas that are impacted. So yeah, lots of things like that kind of behind the scenes going on that we'll hopefully be hearing a lot more about in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I got a question about climate change. And I mean, everybody just says we need to be aware of it, and we need to, I don't know, whatever. Like, I always just struggle with, what do we do? What can I do? And I'm going to give you an example, and it's probably a silly one, but I saw a guy on the news, Aquaman, what is his name? The actor who played Aquaman, whatever, he's from here, he's from Central Iowa, and he was home.
Oh, okay.
And, so he was on every news station because everyone's going to nab him and talk to Aquaman. Right. Shoot, man, I feel so bad. I can't think of his name, but, he was somewhere and he had a plastic water bottle in his hand, disposable one, and he's like, this is just stupid. I'm going to drink 12 ounces of water and throw this away, and it's just going to become garbage and end up in the ocean. And so he started a water company that makes aluminum water bottles, disposable, instead of plastic. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. And I used to drink a Mountain Dew every day out of a bottle. Every single day I had a Mountain Dew.
Every day.
And I was like, you know what? If he can do that, then I don't need to drink a Mountain Dew every day. And so I started bringing a stainless steel container with me to work. Like, I mean, I probably use one plastic bottle every 6 weeks instead of one a day. Mm-hmm. So that's how many? One a day is 365 a year minus 10. So 360, let's say 350 a year I'm not consuming. If there were a million people like me, that's 365 million bottles that aren't needed.
Mm-hmm.
So, to protect our winters, what can a million of us do that might matter a bit? Might matter as much as one bottle of Mountain Dew a day. And when all added up, means something.
No, that's a great way of phrasing a question that so many of us grapple with, is like, can individual action or changes in individuals' actions actually be enough if you get a critical mass to slow down the warming that we're seeing slow down the accumulation of carbon dioxide and methane and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere? And unfortunately, the answer is no. That, you know, we could all change, we could, you know, eat as locally as possible, stop driving vehicles that emit any carbon, you know, minimize everything we do that's reliant on fossil fuels individually. And it's not enough. Like, it's going to slow down the increase of the accumulation of those greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, but it's not going to level off. It's not going to even come close to reversing. And what we need are more systemic changes, because so much of the impact that that the big developed countries around the world have is emissions through industry, through things like the governments supporting and having so many subsidies for oil extraction and gasoline refining and all the things like that. And you don't see comparable subsidies to support green energy development and technology improvements for green energy, things like that. And that's what we need to see, is actually make it reasonable for people to have options that don't necessarily require as much fossil fuel consumption individually. And there's certain things that, you know, it's not feasible that everybody's going to switch to electric vehicles and that we're going to see all the industrial, you know, commercial construction equipment switch to, like, we're still going to be needing to burn fossil fuels for certain things. But with much more support for innovation in green energy, innovation in how energy is stored, which is something that us as individuals don't have any impact on, the, you know, the creation of that and that innovation, those are the things that are going to make the big difference. And those are the things that there needs to be federal legislation, federal support, or state level support for. And we've been starting to see a little bit more of that. When was it? Was it a year ago? 2 years ago? I forget now. Was the biggest climate legislation that was ever passed by Congress. And that included a lot of funding for research and technology development, which was a first for the green energy sector, and subsidies to help with green energy kind of technology rollout. So that's that was a step in the right direction. And that's the kind of thing that we need a lot more of in the coming years. And so I think, you know, individual actions is something that we can all do that have a very small impact in terms of, you know, how we, what our behavior is in terms of the consumption of fossil fuels and other resources. But being engaged, and, you know, this is not nearly as fun as a lot of other things we could be doing, but being engaged in the policy world a little bit, supporting organizations that are engaged in Washington, working in Washington, and thinking about how we vote. Unfortunately, that is, you know, our representatives are the ones who are making a lot of those decisions. And there's a lot that can be done at the local level. So not necessarily state representatives or federal, like at the Congress level, but in communities and at the county level with county commissioners, that those are folks that do have a lot of power to influence things at the state level. And if states are starting to see more and more communities that are asking the governor or the state legislator to do certain things, that has an impact. And so acting locally and being involved locally is a way that people really can have an impact that isn't going to be huge in scale immediately, but can grow steadily over time.
So what I hear you saying is all of us who want to just cover our ears and shut our eyes for the next period of time, 4 years or so, instead of doing that, we should be connecting with those who do make the decisions in mm-hmm. whatever way. A, by voting, and B, by, I mean, I have always heard that letters matter. Letters mm-hmm. to people in Congress and the House and all that. And being involved locally is a positive thing. I like the idea of that yeah. county thing. We can all picture the county. It's right. I mean, it's the people our kids go to school with. It's people we go to church with. It's people we see in the grocery store. It's the people, like, we know these people. It's not mm-hmm. far away in Washington and you feel like you're not heard, but you can actually talk to these people face to face. So that's a great idea.
Yep.
I actually,
yeah. And there's a few communities I know of around the country that have created small local organizations that are dedicated to climate action. And I mean, like Lander, Wyoming is an example. It has a little one that a friend helped create called the Lander Climate Action Network. And they've been really active just at the very local level and have been impactful. And I mean, they had, I think at the first meeting they had like 80 people show up that were curious to learn more and potentially be involved. So, you know, even in places that you don't necessarily expect, there might be a lot of enthusiasm for that sort of thing. It can be there if there, and it can coalesce if there's somebody or a few people that are able to kind of organize and get those people together. And like we were talking about earlier with having a spark or, you know, that excitement to start conversations, that maybe that's what it takes.
Yeah. And I think also supporting those who do lobby on our behalf and do the work in Washington or on the Hill in your own state, like Protect Our Winners, and Bikepacking Roots, lobbying for the recreation side, which impacts people's perception of the outdoors and their enjoyment of the outdoors and their want to protect the outdoors if they recreate in the outdoors. So all of that, get involved.
Yep, get involved and support the people that are doing the work.
Yeah, and make yourself feel good by not drinking 365 Mountain Dews a year.
That's a lot of Mountain Dews in a year.
It is. I know. When you have just one a day, it's like, whatever. But you add it up, and then you're like, man, if just a million people did that, that's like 360 million bottles not being used, but. Speaking of bottles and aluminum bottles, Jason Momoa.
Oh, yes.
That's who that is.
That's right.
Jason Momoa. Yep. So if you need portable, disposable water, look for his Aquaman water. It's kind of funny. I just realized Aquaman. Kurt Refsnyder, good to see you again. I'm sure we enjoyed some of the same rides together. That's too funny. It's
no, I
make that connection again.
Thinking about it more, I remember you hanging out with our crew at the what was it, the Memorial Day races?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yep.
Like
yep. Love the Memorial Day races.
Snake Alley, Quad Cities Crit, that whole.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Too funny. Good to see you again.
Yep. Likewise, Dave.
All right, good luck on all your efforts, and congrats on all the successes that you've had and will continue to have. So it's a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks for the conversation. That was so much fun.
Now, this is a dude with many talents, passion, and knowledge. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kurt as much as I did, and I absolutely appreciate A, his time for coming on the pod, and B, all he does for the bikepacking community. Be sure to look him up on Instagram. Both he and his organization he founded, Bikepacking Roots. And while you're at it, give Protect Our Winters a follow too. It's now more important than ever to support those that help make our adventures possible. Speaking of adventures, I know spring is just around the corner, but it is still deep winter here in the Midwest. We're looking at a snowy and cold week with lows in the negative teens and highs barely above zero. So if you're still out riding, and I know lots of you are, you gotta check out Pogi Lights from BikeIowa.com. They're lightweight and easy to use and keep your hands warm and dry, whether you're on a mountain bike or a drop bar gravel bike. They're so adaptable to a variety of conditions, and if you don't need them, you just roll them up and put them in your pocket. Super easy. Check them out on the online store at PogiLights.com. And thanks again for tuning in today. Next up is the new Mid-America USA cycling rep, as well as gravel and cyclocross race promoter, and a longtime friend of mine, Vance Fletcher. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And I would love it if you would rate and review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you want to support the show financially, I would welcome that. If you would drop some coins in the cup at buymeacoffee.com, just look for Bike Talk with Dave. And be sure to give the show a follow on Instagram, Facebook, and even YouTube. And if you're trying to tune in on your computer, you can just go to biketalk.bike and every episode is there and easily streamable. Now, I hope you have a great week, joyful week, and keep on riding, because nothing compares to the simple pleasure of riding a bicycle.